about him. The show's all about it. Melbourne wants to shout it. We're gonna tell you all about it. Matthew Bronson.
In a previous conversation with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR, we sat down with Dr. Alan Firestone and put out on the air part one. This is part two of that conversation, so please stay tuned for more of Dr. Alan Firestone here on Conversation with Matthew Bronson on KUPR.
So you're in pre-med, then you're in med school, and you're playing music, and you're doing. And so you said, hey, I need to take up soccer too, because I have too much darn free time.
Sort of got into soccer after the I played a little bit in high school, because, you know, one of the things in a prep school is that you have to do sports all seasons. So that meant, playing soccer and then swimming and then maybe, trying to do track as far as trying to learn pole vaulting, which I never did manage to really get much of an idea on it. But the thing is that soccer at that point was, there was varsity, junior varsity, junior A, junior B, junior C, junior D, and maybe there was a junior E, whatever it was. I was on the lowest team. But I had an idea of how you played soccer, and it was fun. I enjoyed it. And so when the kids started playing soccer out here, playing up at the Placidus Elementary School on the dirt field with the goat heads.
Right.
We would go out and kick it around with them, and then when they were in leagues in Bernalillo, the adults would go ahead and kick it around and scrimmage a little bit after the kids got done. And then Marty Enright said, why don't you come and join our co-ed team? And then after a while, why don't you come on and join our Division III, Division IV team? And then somehow I wound up on a Division II team for a while. And basically from the time I started playing, I haven't stopped. And we really don't take any time off. I've got the T-shirt that has the Eskimo running by the igloo with the soccer ball being chased by a polar bear. And, the igloo is painted like a soccer ball. And it says there is no off season. And we play straight through the winter. There's the regular team, the Sunday team for the spring and fall is pretty well mixed as far as having some of our kids and on the team. And now most of the team is made up of kids who went to St. Pius. But there are a few of us who are over 60 who are still on the team and still playing. But then there's also over 48 and over 55 up in Santa Fe. And we get a couple games in a week.
And so at this point, you are done with your official education to become a physician. And you were done with your internship also?
Yes. Yeah.
And was there a reason that you went to UCLA?
Well, UCLA was interesting. In the middle of my junior year at Oberlin, there was a notice up about a NASA-sponsored Summer Institute in Space Biology.
Okay.
And at that time, being an astronaut sounded like a really interesting thing to do, and space medicine was intriguing. And so I put in for it. And I didn't get it. Bill Krassoff got it. And then for some reason, he couldn't go. And so I went out and spent 6 weeks out at in California, I think it was 6 weeks, maybe it was less, at UCLA mostly, and the classes were being taught by the med school professors, and the classes were fascinating. And we had field trips up to Jet Propulsion Lab and several other field trips to the bases in the area. And learned a tremendous amount. And I figured, okay, well, I'm out here at UCLA. I might as well go ahead and go interview for med school. Figured that'd be a good thing to do.
Sure.
And
you already save airfare.
Yeah. And I had I must have already taken the medical college admission test in my spring of my junior year at Oberlin, because those results had must have been out at that point.
Right.
So before I left LA, I interviewed at UCLA and got an acceptance letter October 1st of my senior year at Oberlin. So basically, without having applied anyplace else, I knew I was in UCLA.
Right.
So all I had to do was just continue doing reasonably well with studies. And,
sure. And at what point in your growing up did you say medicine?
Well, I grew up with medicine. My mother's father was a doctor. My uncle was a doctor, although he didn't want to be. My mother wanted to be a doctor, and they wouldn't let her. So she wound up being a medical technologist and then working in the office.
Right.
My dad grew up in a family that was really fairly poor. His father was a milkman and delivered milk and booze during Prohibition. And his mother...
I know which one paid better.
Yeah. His mother worked as a translator for the local doctor in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. And basically spoke probably Russian, Polish, Hungarian, and Slovak, and would translate for the doctor. And so he grew up with enough interest in medicine that he then paid his way through Ohio State, working in the off semesters. Yeah, working as a shoe salesman, and knew he wanted to be a doctor, went to medical school, and went into practice. Ultimately went into practice with my mother's father, met my mother, and then they got married. So I grew up in a household with medicine all over the place, and grew up going on house calls with Dad and going to the office and spending time at the office and going to the hospital and spending time at the hospital, and knew that I really didn't want to do this. that was when I was trying to be my own person, so I figured research biology. But then I found out that the place where most of the research was being done was it really in human biology and medicine.
Right.
And so I figured, okay, I'll go into medicine, I'll be a research doctor. And then when I got in the wards, I found the thing I liked best was sitting on a patient's bed and talking to him.
Which is unusual for a doctor.
Not so much. No. But
I guess it depends on your experiences. I unfortunately have spent more time in the hospital bed with doctors coming and going. And I don't know if they appreciated it or just took it in their stride that here's an obnoxious patient. But I knew a lot of these folks were coming through because they were part of the team and they had to check that off or they couldn't submit a bill. And I don't know what you're making for sticking your head in here. And to many of them, I don't even know why you're here, but I'm going to assume there's a good reason. So I need at least 5 minutes. You can talk about the weather or movies or something, but I need to feel like I'm getting my money's worth. And they would do it eventually. Fortunately, the physicians who were what I considered to be taking care of me did an excellent job. And they were all almost overly interested. It's like, don't you have a life? Why are you here? So with that said, you liked the social aspect of it.
Yeah.
But didn't know that.
Was not mature enough to realize it. And then when I did realize it, pretty quickly figured out that what I wanted to do was family practice.
And that brings you to El Pueblo. Well, let me back up before El Pueblo Family Health Services. When did you come to New Mexico, and was that immediately Placitas?
After finishing med school at UCLA, we went to North Carolina for 3 years for residency. So a three-year family practice residency in a small, well, not so small, but in a community hospital. So Greensboro at that time was 125,000 people. And we were really the referral for the surrounding communities. And so I got to see everything and got really good training. Well, finishing up residency at age 23.
Is that typical? Just for all of us who don't know, I'm going to assume it's like 10 years early.
Well, no, it's about 5 years early.
Okay.
But no, I'm sorry. I finished when I was 27. But the thing is that that was right after I finished residency, right after Vietnam ended. I figured there was no way we were going to stay out of another war for the next 8 or 10 years that I had when I was still eligible to be drafted as a doctor. And so I looked at public health service.
Right.
And the National Health Service Corps, part of the public health service, their goal was to go ahead and put physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants in small communities where they had not been able to go ahead and recruit a doctor. So there was a 20-page form to fill out with your history and what you'd done and where you wanted to be. So we listed everything except for Region 6, which was Louisiana, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, and New Mexico. And so a few weeks later, I got
That's
a call.
It's an odd grouping.
Yeah, a few weeks later, I get a call from somebody in Region 6 saying, how come you didn't list our region?
You hurt their feelings.
I said, I didn't want to go to Louisiana or Arkansas. And they said, well, we got some really nice places along the Rio Grande in Texas and New Mexico. So we knew that some close friends of ours, Dan Tanberg, who I talked about as far as music earlier.
Right.
And his wife, Nancy, were in Albuquerque. He was in residency at UNM. And so we figured, okay, you know, we'll go look at a place in Bernalillo, in New Mexico, and go visit Dan and Nancy in Albuquerque. And it came out, we really liked it out here. And so came back. We'd been here earlier in that to visit them, and then came back out in January and looked at Bernalillo and decided that, yeah, that looked like it would be a good place to be. And so
this is like late 70s.
This was 70, it was January 76.
Okay.
And so came out to Bernalillo and we started up in August of 1976 at El Pueblo Health Services. We had taken over the clinic that had been a joint venture with Perez and St. Joe's for a few years before, and they'd initially been accepted pretty well, and then the last doctor that they got in, they'd gotten down to seeing, you know, just a couple of patients a day. And so the community took it over and as a National Health Service Corps site. So there were two houses available in Bernalillo. One was handyman's dream. A lot of exposed wiring and,
right.
And curtains instead of doors and things like that. And the other one was just for rent. And there was one house available in Placidus, and that was the one that we bought. So we came out early July, and the practice opened up on August 1st, 40 years ago. So,
yep.
And they will be having their 40th anniversary this year.
That's amazing, and in a wonderful way. And to have that in your life path must make you feel really good.
Oh, it was great.
But when you accepted that position, you were kind of making a decision to not only practice medicine, but to open a business.
No, that was one of the things, was that because you had a community board,
right,
advising you and making business decisions, I was able to go ahead and focus on medicine and not have to worry too much about the business aspects of it.
Oh, that is wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, you said we a few times. Who is the other half of we?
Well, it depends on what it was. we is my wife, BJ, and also Ethan was born in North Carolina. So the three of us moved out here in 1976.
And when did BJ come into the picture?
BJ was a medical social worker at UCLA when I was a student. And when I was rotating on OBGYN, she was the social worker for the for gynecological oncology and for the neonatal intensive care unit and developmental pediatrics. And so I had a little bit of contact with her, and we started dating when I was on, or just after I finished OBGYN, so I guess when I was starting pediatrics.
And not to embarrass you or her, but you were in university settings, and you did a lot of things, and so you came into a lot of contact. What was there about BJ that you said, I want to go out with her?
She was interesting. She could read as fast as I did.
Okay.
And we just had a good time together.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me because I've been in lots of jobs that have put me in contact with a lot of people, and you always wonder, well, why did they hook up? You know, or I can see why they hooked up. So people are fascinating, as you know. You have dealt with them your whole life. Not to go out of order or anything, but when did you become fluent in Spanish?
It was on the job training. It was here. I had one book that was sort of a teach yourself Spanish in 12 lessons kind of thing. And other than that, it was just working at speaking it every day. And having a bit of an aptitude for languages. I'd studied French for a while in actually grade school, middle school, and high school, and then had placed out of taking a language when I got to Oberlin. I did try and take Introduction to French Literature, and that was the only course I ever had to drop. We were reading 100 pages a week in French and writing 10-page papers a week in French, and most of the people I was in there with had either been French majors or had lived half their lives in France.
Yeah, that puts you a little bit of a disadvantage. Yeah. But there was no medical Spanish for dummies.
Not at that time. Marty Kantrowitz and I'm not sure who else was involved in it. They put out a book on medical Spanish. But by that time, I was reasonably fluent. So it was on the job training, and just one. Every once in a while, you would sort of become aware of a milestone, like, you know, getting awakened from a sound sleep by somebody speaking to you in Spanish and understanding what they needed and being able to communicate with them.
Right. I guess it's I don't want to say it's easy, but it's different than learning conversational Spanish. It's almost like in kind of in a way like restaurant Spanish. There are certain things you need to know. You need to know floor and table. And if you're treating a patient, don't need to ask them to explain the difference between cloud types.
Well, you need to be able to explain things to people. And that demands learning a lot of workarounds as far as when you're trying to explain medical terminology to somebody on a lay term terminology in English. It's difficult enough, and right. So you have to be a teacher. And then to do it in another language becomes even more complicated. The just knowing 2, 3, 4 words in a language is not much help.
Right.
If you can ask someone, you know, do you hurt? And they say yes, and you say point to where it hurts. You know, that's a little bit of a help. But if you're able to go ahead and get a complete story of when it started hurting, what it feels like, it makes a big difference. But when you're starting out, you obviously make pretty egregious grammatical errors. So that you tell someone, I need to examine you now. I need you to take your clothes off and put on the gown with the back open. And you step out of the room and come back in and find them stark naked sitting on top of the gown on top of the table. You know that something has gone wrong in the translation. So you gradually learn how to explain things a little bit better. But it's a process. And over 37 years speaking Spanish with maybe a third of my patients, you get to where you get reasonably good at it.
I would think so. Did the having the core knowledge of Latin from medical school help?
Having the core knowledge of Latin from high school and French, that helps a lot. And Spanish is probably the easiest of the three languages, the three Romance languages that I'm pretty familiar with as far as being able to speak it, because what it looks like on paper is what it sounds like, and and the forms are a bit easier than like Italian,
right?
And you can get away with a little bit more, but
we don't deal with a lot of past pluperfect in English, or at least knowingly, as you would in when you're conjugating French verbs.
Yeah, but you can get away with speaking mostly, past and present and future. If you got those three, I think you're pretty much okay.
I'm sure we have all heard things that resemble English, and we do understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
I'd be neglectful if I did not include the Navy Reserves. Was that a draft avoidance technique?
No, actually, after putting in 2-3 years in the Public Health Service and National Health Service Corps, that pretty well took care of my military obligation. The problem was that after 11 years, Public Health Service said, listen, you got to move to a different clinic site or you got to get out. And I said, well, who would replace me here in Bernalillo? And they said, well, there's nobody in the pipeline. So I said, okay, I'm out. And sure. Really about 3 years before, 4 years before, I'd turned down the annual bonus because if you accepted the bonus, then they could move you.
Right.
They could say, you will move. And so I basically knocked off about 30% of my income for the 3 or 4 year period in order to have the freedom to stay put. When I got out of the
you didn't have to move into the school bus with your friend.
No.
Okay.
No.
So you were okay.
Yeah. When I got out of the Public Health Service, it was, so in 1988, 87 is when I got out of Public Health Service. And I thought, I've got 11 years in toward some retirement. I'm not able to go ahead and put away a lot of money otherwise. There is no retirement. And so if we get into another war situation, I'd like to be able to go ahead and provide good care for any of our guys.
Right.
And so I talked to the Navy Reserve recruiter. And I told him that the last time I talked to a recruiter was when I was at Oberlin. We had him trapped in his car.
Okay.
And we're feeding him coffee and donuts, which I thought was really nice. But if you're trapped in your car and somebody's feeding you coffee, that's probably not real comfortable.
No. But eventually.
Yeah. But they didn't hold that against me. And so.
But you felt the need to confess.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or batter, I think, is probably a better word. But. Anyway, it took about a year to get in, but I spent 10 years in the Navy Reserve and really enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought that the people that I was working with were, very highly motivated, very educated, and really enjoyed it.
Did you have to do the equivalent of like a boot camp or?
No.
Learn how to tie knots?
There was a direct commissioned officer's indoctrination course, which was fondly referred to as the direct commissioned officer impersonation course.
Okay.
At Pensacola. Somehow I managed to have done, I think it was three active duties before I ever went through that. So, you basically learn from watching other people,
right.
And you got the books and you can read them.
And so where did you have to go on active duty?
Well, the active duties that I did, the first one, not knowing any better, I looked and, the needs of the Navy, they need somebody to fill in at the Naval Medical Clinic in New Orleans. So
the one place you didn't want to go.
New Orleans was BJ's home. Okay. So BJ's from New Orleans. Her parents are there. So
I was referring to the National Health.
Oh yeah. Well, I didn't want to practice. Six, so. Didn't want to practice up in northern Louisiana. And so I went out there the first time. Then after I did that, then they said, yeah, you're really supposed to go to the indoctrination course first, and also you need to go to Camp Pendleton, and you need to. So the next one was Camp Pendleton with the Fleet Hospital Operations and Training Command, and so we were a fleet hospital. You know, we never got near a ship that would have been land-based in support of Marines. And then finally, the third year, I went out to Pensacola, and that was right during Gulf One. So, so I was at Pensacola with taking the course, and wasn't sure that I would get back to Albuquerque before I got shipped off to Iraq.
Jeez.
Or Kuwait.
Right.
And then several other times out at Camp Pendleton, another time at Pensacola, and finally, my last 2 years, one was in Naval Medical Clinic London, and one in Naval Medical Clinic Gaeta, Italy. And so
doesn't
that
sound like rough service.
Well, but the needs of the Navy. You need to
right.
You need to have a doc, and somebody was going on vacation, and I'd done everything I needed to do as far as my training. So
right.
Made use of the
excellent.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, we thank you for your service.
I always feel a little guilty about that statement.
Your biggest complaints were, I don't think the biscotti are fresh today.
Well, my biggest complaint was at 6:30 in the morning, and this bar says it's supposed to be open at 5, so I can get some coffee and a Cornetto before I go to work.
So then you are here in Placitas, and that was over 30 years ago?
That was 40 years ago. It'll be 40 years in July.
Right. And the Merck, I believe, is celebrating 20 years.
Yeah.
So what was life like in Placitas 40 years ago? The 165 exit wasn't here, was it?
Yeah, it was. It was. But you knew everybody on the road on 165. It was still 44 at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But so you would never pass a car without waving.
Sure.
There weren't very many cars. You didn't have to wait for 3 minutes before you could make a left-hand turn. There were only 1,500 people up here at that time.
And how many of them were the original village people, for lack of a better way to?
I'd say probably about a third were the original village people, a third were retirees who worked either at Los Alamos or Sandia, or retired military, and probably about a third were people who'd moved out here for the as Matt talked about, the communes, and so hippies who came out here and were living in communes and growing marijuana, and then sort of said, I need to do something else, and so they went into construction or development.
And that is the point where real estate started to boom in Placitas, is
yep.
when the former hippies became general contractors.
That had a lot to do with it.
Wow.
And then there were a couple of people who moved in from California and started developing.
Was that whole plaza where the Merck is now, that was not here either?
No, there was nothing there.
So where?
There were a couple houses on the west side of 165, and maybe one or two small houses, and then you hit Ranchos, and that was the first thing on the west. The area where Vista del Oro is now was BLM land.
Right.
And people would go out dove hunting on the land. And that was involved in the Elena Gallegos land grant swap.
So where did you or BJ go to get milk or diapers or scotch?
Well, the diapers, there was a diaper service in Albuquerque, and you'd take a load of dirty diapers down and swap them for a load of clean diapers. And milk, there was the Merck in Bernalillo, now TNT, or the next closest market was at the Far North shopping center. There was a Smith's down there where the where Wild Oats and now Sprouts is.
Okay. So the old TNT was the Merck. Is there a relationship between that Merck and this Merck?
No.
Okay.
No. It just Mercantile. The okay. old Bernalillo Mercantile was founded by the Seligmans, mm-hmm. And basically sold everything from fence posts to Stetson hats and groceries. Well, actually no. That the grocery store was the Economy grocery store, which was owned by Lalo Torres, who was the mayor of Bernalillo. And that was down on the corner of Camino del Pueblo and Calle Bernalillo.
Any relationship to the current mayor Torres?
His dad.
Okay.
And
well, that reminds me of back in the I guess 70s when Malcolm Forbes was being interviewed when he was turning the reins of the of his publishing over to his son, and a reporter asked him how he. You know, how did he feel about nepotism? And he said it was, it's fine as long as you keep it in the family. So,
I guess. Well, you know, Jack's really interesting. Jack was trained at Harvard. He went to undergraduate at Harvard and came back to Bernalillo to go ahead and take over his dad's store. And then they developed the larger TNT market with his brother Joe. So he... You know, educated in Bernalillo and then at Harvard, so really well trained, really intelligent, very nice guy, and very well suited to be mayor as far as just personality types.
And he seems to have had a very successful administration.
I think so.
So, but this is about you, not yeah. he. So then, this was it wasn't even really a place. Placidus. There, it was just a few people lived out here.
Yeah, there were a couple collections of houses, Placidus West, Placidus Heights, Ranchos. And other than that, they were scattered along the highway or scattered along some of the side roads, but no major, no other major developments.
And no casinos?
Oh, no casinos.
Was that a big deal when you heard, hey, they're putting in casinos?
I don't like the idea of casinos as far as the fact that they're that people tend to blow money that they shouldn't blow. On the other hand,
that's the business they're in.
Yeah. on the other hand, as an income source for the pueblos, mm-hmm. I think the pueblos deserve to be able to go ahead and make some money off of the people that have made money off them for many years.
Certainly. I mean, Ohio, UCLA, Massachusetts. You were not a small town boy, and then you're out here, and you're an adult at this point. You go, but it's almost like when I wanted to move out here once my wife retired, and we've traveled a lot, and you know, checked out the old Phoenix and the Scottsdale thing, and you immediately write them off or whatever, and then you come out here and you go Albuquerque, and then you go Placidus, and it. Fortunately, it was instant love at first sight for her, but it's not you know, the East Coast of Florida near Orlando or Washington D.C. or you know other places we've lived. Did that cross your mind, or BJ's going, Alan? Are you sure you want to do this? We do have a child.
I don't know. Not so much. I wanted to go ahead and try practicing in a relatively rural area. The National Health Service Corps was a means to go ahead and do that. When we came out here and settled in, I was busy. I was working, you know, being on call essentially on first call every other night and every other weekend, and on second call all the rest of the time. And for delivering babies, I was on call all the time unless I was out of town and could turn it over to somebody else in town. The real stress was on BJ, whether she could go ahead and settle in, but made some very good friends out here. There were a lot of kids in the area, But it is very isolated. Fortunately, BJ is one who values her alone time too. Mm-hmm. And so she did not feel as cut off as a lot of people do when they first move out here.
Right. Sunport was here?
Sunport was here.
Okay,
yeah.
So you had access to the world.
Yeah. And actually, my parents would occasionally fly in and land at Coronado Airport and come visit. Coronado Airport is the area southeast of Tramway and I-25.
Okay.
So that was a little private strip.
They came in on their Gulfstream and...
No, it was a Beechcraft Bonanza.
Okay. we need to wrap this up, and I realized we missed what I consider a very important aspect of your life. Is 30 years ago, I think this year, the Placidus Artist series started. And were you part of that from the beginning?
No. Other than as a loyal attendee.
30 years ago, how many people were there to attend?
I mean, enough. We usually got a pretty good turnout even then.
And then you slowly just became more involved.
Well, it was more when I had more time available, then I joined the board. But I think, particularly with studying music from Willie, I've been pretty much in the loop as far as knowing what's going on from
right.
pretty much the onset.
Now, just between us girls, how is Willie as a teacher?
Oh, he's great. Aside from working on some of the technical things, most of the time what we do is we sit around, play duets, and talk.
Okay. And how did you find him as a teacher? I know you found him great as a teacher, but how did you just hook up with him?
I think I was referred by the other teacher that I had for a brief period where we could never manage to get a good time for a lesson. So right. It was constantly getting canceled, and I think at that point somebody said, go see Willie.
That's probably been an amazing experience.
So. Oh, it has been. We've had a great time.
Yeah. Well, Alan, Dr. Firestone, is there any nook and cranny we haven't discussed? Anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think one of the things is that practicing medicine in Bernalillo for 37 years, you deal with families, so that it at one time or another, I've dealt with up to six generations of a family.
How exciting!
So taking care of great grandfather and grandfather and father, delivering the baby, and then taking care of the baby's child. It becomes very interesting. You're part of the community. You really get to know people and families and so a lot of the family dynamics. And my dad used to say, why do you want to go into family practice? All you're going to see is sore throats and colds. Yeah, and plague and multiple sclerosis and ALS and leptospirosis and
gunshots
yes. and knife wounds and auto accidents and brucellosis and
because part of the job is therapist, mental therapist.
Oh yeah, just. Yeah. Very very large part of family practice is being a psychiatrist.
So almost everybody in Placidus and Bernalillo is part of your family, or a large percentage of it.
At one point, we probably had 10,000 charts. There's probably more than that now, but and so it was like being a parent to 10,000 children, where you were never really completely off call. On the other hand, it really didn't interfere with allowing me to do most of the things that I wanted to do.
Right. Well, it sounds like you've had an absolute blast.
Oh, it's been great. And retirement's great.
So what's next? The Today Show?
No. No. Next is got a ticket to go see Northern Ireland against Germany in Paris, June 22nd, for the Euro Cup. We've got some soccer tournaments coming up in July up in Denver, and
okay.
October down at Casa Grande, Arizona. I'm organizing the over 48 soccer team from Albuquerque to go up to Santa Fe. That'll start in April. This Saturday is amateur chamber music players worldwide play-in. So you know we're having any of my friends who want to come up and play chamber music up at our house on Saturday.
You ever participate in that Drunken Hash organization?
No, I'm not a runner. I don't run unless I've got a soccer ball in front of me or somebody with a soccer ball in front of me.
Well, I was just going to do the drinking part. I wasn't going to do the running part.
I'm good for one beer, and that's it.
Well, hopefully it's a local New Mexico beer.
Absolutely.
Which we're getting to be pretty good at. And
I think so.
Recognized. Well, on that note, it's difficult to express my appreciation for taking time out of your day. And when I say your busy day, I can really mean it this time.
Oh yeah.
And sharing so openly about your life and about Placitas, which is kind of what this program is all about. So for KUPR. And Conversations with Matthew Bronson, and today, Dr. Alan Firestone, 40 years in Placitas. Thank you.
Thank you.